Maya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo
Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Muted.
So it's November 30th, 2022 in Hawaii. I hope you're all alright with the volcano. And we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, Chapter 7, The Activities of King Bharata. And we're reading text 2 to 4. So this is prose verse, text 2. Tasyam huha va atmajam karchnyen anurupam Atmana pancha janayam asha bhutadir Iva bhuta shukshmani sumatin Rasta brutam sudarshanam avaran dumraketum iti. Tasyam, in her womb. Uhava, indeed. Atmajan. Sons.
Sons.
Kartsneha.
Shneha Kartsneha.
Entirely.
Entirely.
Anurupam.
Anurupam.
Exactly like.
Exactly like.
Atmanaha.
Atmanaha.
Himself.
Himself.
Pancha.
Pancha.
Five.
Five.
Janayam. Janayam Asha.
Janayam Asha.
Begot.
Begot.
Bhuta Adi Eva.
Bhuta Adi Eva.
Like the false ego.
Like the false ego.
Bhuta Shukshmani.
Bhuta Shukshmani.
The five subtle objects of sense perception. Sumatim.
Sumatim.
Rastra Britam.
Rastra Brit.
Sudarshanam. Sudarshana.
Sudarshana.
Avaranam.
Avarana.
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 Dumraketu.
Dumraketu.
Iti.
Iti.
Thus.
Thus.
Muted. Unmuted.
Srila Prabhupada's translation. Just as the false ego creates the subtle sense objects, Maharaj Bharata created five sons in the womb of Panchajani, his wife. These sons were named Sumati, Rastabrit, Sudarshana, Avarana, and Dumaketu. Now, I thought for quite a while about why there's this particular simile given. Because it seems that anytime anybody has children, we're using the three objects of the false ego, Bhuta Adi Eva, like that, to Bhuta Shukshmani, the objects of sense perception. If we refer to Bhagavatam, third canto, chapter 26, so there. Lord Kapila Dev, in verse 26, gives the three items of the false ego, kartitvam, karanatvam, and karyatvam. So kartitvam is the doer, karanatvam is the instruments, and karyatvam is the effect. So there's a doer that uses some instruments to get an effect, and these are considered... it's not so much of an explanation there of why these are the three parts of false ego, but one can understand that kartitvam is I am the doer, and karanatvam is that I am the cause. I am doing something and I am causing an effect. And karyatvam has to do with possessiveness. These are my effects. Now, Kapila Dev also, as kind of an aside, in text 22, he gives the three stages of pure consciousness. Swachatvam, clarity. Avikaritvam, freedom from distraction. And Shantatvam, or peacefulness. And Bhakti Vigyan Maharaj felt that there was a correlation between the three aspects of false ego and the three aspects of pure ego. So that I am the doer is the opposite to clarity. And with clarity of the real ego, we see that everything is being done by the modes of nature and the will of the Lord. I am not the doer. So I am the cause is the opposite to freedom from distraction. That's avikaritvam. Because when I think I'm the cause, I'm very bound up in past, present, and future. I do something at this time, and I'm the cause of an effect that happens at another time. And freedom from distraction means you're absorbed in the present moment. Then thinking about effects, karyatvam, is the opposite of shantatvam, peacefulness, because thinking about effects means I'm thinking I own so many things, and peacefulness means being free from feelings of possessiveness. It means nasochatina kanchati. I don't care about getting things, I don't care about losing things. Anyway, so there are these three aspects of the false ego. I am the doer, I am the cause, and I am the possessor of the effects. So that could be related to having children. The father is the cause, the mother is the instrument, and the effects are the children. And this is true any time that any entities that reproduce, especially by sexual reproduction, have children. So why particularly Sukadev Goswami is using this simile in reference to Maharaj Bharata is not clear. I don't know. There's no commentaries. There's no explanation. But just to note that that's what they're talking about. Okay, text 3. Ajan abhyam namaitad varsham bharatam iti yata arabhya vyapadishya isyanti. Formerly this planet was known as Ajanabhavarsha, but since Maharaj Bharata's reign, it has become known as Bharatavarsha. Prabhupada has a short purport here. This planet was formerly known as Ajanabha because of the reign of King Nabi. After Bharat Maharaj ruled the planet, it became celebrated as Bharatavarsha. And of course, today India, people from India speaking in Hindi call India Bharat. They don't call India India. That's just not a spiritual thing, but just something that's always amused me and confused me, as if I'm going to refer to the name of something, why would I not refer to the name that the people in that place call it themselves? Why do I create another different name? And such is the case for so many countries in the world. I mean, Germany we call Germany, but the people in Germany call it Deutschland. They don't call it Germany. So it's just very peculiar to me. I mean, the name India doesn't mean anything more than the name Bharat. Why don't I use the name that the Indians call their own country? I mean, for United States, that's a very descriptive name. The United States, of course, America. But anyway, it's just interesting that in so many countries, we create a different name for places than people use themselves. Anyway, I had a discussion with one man from India about why in a lecture I was talking about the Ganges River instead of the Ganga. He was very upset. Why are you calling it the Ganges? That's an English name. Why don't you call it the Ganga? And I said, well, there's so many people in the audience who don't have much background in India or, you know, Indian culture, and if I was talking about the Ganga, they might not know what I was talking about. And I'm giving a class in America, so I'm speaking in English. But anyway, I don't think he ever really understood that. But in any case, it's something that's always, I've always found amusing and confusing. Okay, going on to text 4. Sa bahu, because I was asked to. Sa bahuvim mahipati patir pita havad uru vatsal attaya sve sve karmani vartmanana praja swadharmam anuvartamana parya palayat. Madhav Bharat was a very learned and experienced king on this earth. He perfectly ruled the citizens, being himself engaged in his own respective duties. Maharaj Bharata was as affectionate to the citizens as his father and grandfather had been. Keeping them engaged in their occupational duties, he ruled the earth. Srila Prabhupada's purport. It is most important that the chief executive rule the citizens by keeping them fully engaged in their respective occupational duties. Some of the citizens were brahmanas, some were kshatriyas, and some were vaishyas and shudras. It is the duty of the government to see that the citizens act according to these material divisions for their spiritual advancement. I'm going to read that again. It is the duty of the government. So whose duty? The duty of the government. To see that the citizens act according to these material divisions for their spiritual advancement. So we have that it's the duty of the government. We have that these are material divisions. But we have that they can be acted in for spiritual advancement. No one should remain unemployed or unoccupied in any way. One must work as a Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, or Shudra on the material path. And on the spiritual path, everyone should act as a Brahmachari, Grahastha, Vanaprastha, or Sannyasi. And Srila Prabhupada often distinguishes that as that the ashrams are spiritual. Although formerly the government was a monarchy, all the kings were very affectionate toward the citizens, and they strictly kept them engaged in their respective duties. Thus, society was very smoothly conducted. Maharaj Bharata was a very learned and experienced king on this earth. He perfectly ruled the citizens, being himself engaged in his own respective duties. Maharaj Bharata was as affectionate to the citizens as his father and grandfather had been, keeping them engaged in their occupational duties. He ruled the earth. So he did his duties and he made sure that everybody did their duties in such a way that they would advance spiritually. That's a way that they would advance spiritually. So we'd like to look primarily here at Varna, although we can look a little bit here at Ashrama as well. So why is it that these material divisions can be used for spiritual advancement? I mean, that sounds kind of funny. And we're going to look at that individually and then collectively. And then we're going to look at why this is the duty of the government. So what does it mean that you can do your material duties, material divisions, for spiritual advancement? I mean, this is a question I've been asking for a very, very long time. And I believe that after many, many years, over 5 years of in-depth research from Shastra and from empirical sources on this topic, I've been able, with the help of my dear friend Rukmini, I've been able to gain at least some understanding of how it is that this division, according to Brahman, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra, enables, although it's a material division, it's a division for your work, for your career, for your livelihood, for how you maintain your body, how you maintain the material side of society, still how it acts for spiritual advancement. I mean, my overarching question is, why divide up humans in this way at all? I mean, the Brahmachari, Grahastha, Vanaprastha, and Sannyas are very obvious stages of biological and psychological life. I mean, Shakespeare had 7 divisions of life, so one could divide this up further A brahmacharya could be divided into, say, childhood and adolescence, although in, you know, in ancient times, grihastha started generally during adolescence. So there could be further divisions, but these general divisions are of a natural biological process. We're a child, then we're an adult in the prime of life, then we're in middle age, and then we're in old age. And each of these stages of life have corresponding psychological inclinations. There's a different psychological inclination that happens when you're 10 as to when you're 25, and that changes. You know, you hit 50, 60 years old, it changes, and then you hit 70, 80 years old, and it changes again. And this is true pretty much for everybody. And the idea of spiritualizing those stages of life is to take the natural biological and psychological proclivities and to use them in a way that helps us remember the Lord. And particularly the ashrams have to do with material attachment and detachment in general. That's really what they're about. They're really about attachment and detachment. But if we look at the varnas, it's a little bit harder to see. If you didn't already have that model, it's a little harder to see how they naturally exist. I mean, we had Plato that divided society up into three main divisions. And people will talk about, business and labor, for example. And of course, everybody has a concept of government. So, we have some of these, but we may have a lot of other divisions. I mean, if you research online, if you use any kind of search engine, and you research career fields, you're going to get dozens of different divisions of careers, not these four. You're really going to get, the trades, the arts. I mean, so many different ways of dividing careers. So why these four? What is the, Krishna says, chaturvanya maya shristam, four, chaturvanya maya shristam. I have created these four divisions. So the reason is that these are four different sets of values and dharma. We have this word in today's verse, swadharma. Right? Swadharma. Doing your own dharma. Now, dharma means, as Prabhupada explained so many times, that which is inherent or intrinsic, the authentic nature of something, like the dharma of sugar is sweetness. The dharma of chili is to be spicy. If you have chilies that have no spice, they're useless. If you have sugar that's not sweet, it's useless. So the dharma is the essential nature of the thing. And basically Krishna has created work so that there are four distinct natures, four distinct values. And this doesn't exist necessarily with other types of division. Just like I was speaking to one devotee the other day who's 26 years old and trying to figure out what his career is. And he said, what's the point of this system of varnas? Can't we just use like personality tests? And we were discussing that. I was discussing that with Rukmini and this other devotee. And we were saying that if you work in a way that's in opposition to your natural personality by some of these personality tests, you might feel awkward, you might feel fatigued, but you're not going to feel that you're necessarily in violation of your dharma. Mm-hmm. It's a different thing. That when you feel that you're violating your dharma, you feel like you're violating your ideals and your values, it's almost a kind of self-hatred that evolves. And each of the four varnas have very different values. I've talked about this many times. And these values are in opposition to one another. The Shudras are, they provide the foundational security for society. And their main interest is security in the status quo, because that's what they're doing. They're maintaining the functional status quo of society. And the Vaishyas are supposed to take care of their own profit before they make a profit for society. And if they don't do that, their profit making isn't sustainable. Therefore, Prabhupada say the Vaishyas, if they say, I'm not making a profit, they're lying. Because he said it's their dharma to make a profit. They have to do that. They're providing all of the wealth for society, and therefore they have to have a stock load. They have to have a reserve. Whereas the Kshatriyas, they're running toward danger. The Kshatriya, the firefighter, is to me the primary example that the firefighter runs into the fire. Everybody else is running out, the firefighter is running in. I mean, this is also true to some extent for, you know, police officers, military officers. They're running into the building where the guys with the guns are. Everybody else is going away, and they're going towards it. They're going toward the difficulty, whereas the Vaishyas and Shudras, they're not doing that. You know, the Shudras take the least amount of risk, the Vaishyas a little more, the Kshatriyas a lot. And the Brahmanas are also not usually engaged. They're not so engaged with society. I mean, they're willing to go towards danger in the sense of speaking the truth that people might not like. But they're not that involved with running the difficult things of society. Like we see that with Maharaj Vena, you know, the Brahmins came and said, yeah, just put him in charge. And then they went back to their hermitage. And then when it was a problem, they came back and killed him. And then they went back to their hermitages again. It's a different kind of dharma. And the value of one doesn't work in the other. If you have somebody with a Brahmana mentality trying to run a business, they won't be interested in making a profit. They'll be interested in taking care of the customers. They'll give them too low of a price. If somebody with a Vaishya mentality goes into Shudra work, they don't have a love for the craft. They'll automate everything. They'll make it into a factory. They'll be interested in profit and quantity. Whereas the Shudra is interested in the quality and the beauty and the service of their craft. But if a person with a Shudra mentality works as a Vaishya, they don't have long-range concern about sustainable regenerative wealth for society. So if they're running a big agribusiness, they're going to do what's easiest and what's simplest, because that's their mentality. That's their dharma. And so they'll just use, you know, artificial pesticides and fertilizers and just to get, you know, something faster and easier. And the Shudras are supposed to provide all the pleasures for society. So if they work in the field of the Brahmanas, they'll distort knowledge for the sake of sensual pleasures. So we have this thing where everybody is right in their own place. Just like you're not going to put chili into sweet rice. You know, you're not going to put sugar into a fried bitter melon. Things belong in their right place. And when they're in the right place, they're glorious. When they're in the wrong place, they're not. So that's the benefits for society. For society, you want the heart muscles and the heart, and you want the liver cells and the liver, and you want the lung cells in the lungs and the brain cells in the brain. You know, you don't want them migrating all over the body and getting mixed up. There's a differentiation that happens early on in the womb, that different organs provide different functions cooperatively. So that's the benefit for society. But the benefit for and the benefit for society leads to spiritual advancement, because things are peaceful. The Bhagavatam consistently describes spiritual society as being what Prabhupada calls, 195 times he has this phrase, peace and prosperity. So when people are in their right place, when they're acting according to their nature, society is peaceful, and society has natural prosperity. Just like if the body is in order, then the body is healthy. So if the social body is in order, the social body is healthy. Of course, there's other ways in which having people in the right place provide for spiritual advancement other than just everyone's in the right place. Because working according to the Varna Dharma isn't just about linking your nature with your livelihood. It's not just about that. It's about nourishing your nature in the life cycle. In other words, when you're a brahmachari, you learn how to do your career. When you're a grahastha, you work in your career. When you're a vanaprastha, you retire from your career and advise others in their career. And when you're a sannyasi, you give the spiritual basis for career. Varna dharma also involves charity and sharing. So this Prabhupada would talk about spiritual communism. In a varnashram society, you don't have a huge wealth disparity. You don't have a situation where there are people that are suffering in extreme poverty, whereas other people are experiencing, I would say, obscene amounts of wealth. I mean, we have people today that are so wealthy that their wealth exceeds the wealth of countries put together. And they have no possibility in their life of spending all of their money. It's just, you know, people have like $35 billion or $100 billion. And other people don't have enough to eat. So in a society with Varna Dharma, there's sharing of prosperity. And prosperity doesn't just mean cash. There's sharing of all the different types of prosperity. So of course there's going to be people who are richer and poorer according to their destiny. But because you have a mentality of sharing and you have a mentality of charity, which Krishna says very clearly in the 18th chapter, that charity should not be given up even by the great souls. And this is what any, you know, here we have how the king is taking care of the citizens, loving them like a father. So the father wants the children to share. He doesn't want one child to keep all the food for him or herself. He wants the children to share. So the Lord also wants us to share in our prosperity. And then another principle of Varna Dharma is connection with the divine. Having some regular ceremonies, regular yajñas of acknowledging the Lord, connecting with the Lord, at least thanking the Lord for your food or offering your food to the Lord. You have in, even today in religious societies, there's so many ceremonies connected both with the life cycle and with one's work. So many ceremonies of religious connection. And to come to the point where every part of one's work is an offering to the Lord. Not only the results, but the process. Mama Nusrana Yujacha, that we're always thinking of the Lord as we work, that we're offering every moment of our work to the Lord. And that we should work without these false ego aspects of I am the doer, I am the cause, and I am the enjoyer of the result. That we don't act according to false ego. That instead we act according to real ego. That the Lord is the doer, I am just a servant. That I'm connected to the Lord in the present moment, going on His adventure. And that I understand that everything I have is the grace of the Lord to be used in His service, not as my own possessions. And then work should be honest. Work should be honest. In other words, that people are charging a fair price for goods and services, that the goods and services are as described, they're not cheating on the ingredients, that the ingredients of goods are procured fairly without harming any people or nature or animals, that, you know, that no one is being exploited in the work. And that the work that is being done is of real value. It's providing things that are actually needed. A lot of the work in society today is of artificial needs. I have a god sister who is running a cosmetics business, and while I was visiting, one of her employees quit or left or something, and she was in difficulty, so she asked me to help with the business. And so because she's a dear friend of mine, I agreed. So she had a kiosk in a mall, and we were selling these, like, very light sandpaper sort of things that you put them on your fingernails, and they made your fingernails look all shiny without nail polish, because basically they removed the small ridges in your nails. They made your nails a very smooth, reflective surface. Now, we would accost people In the mall, we would, you know, it was a kiosk in the middle of the hallway, and as people were walking down the hallway, we would go up to them with these polishers, and we would say, hey, can I demonstrate this? And we would demonstrate it on one nail, and they would be astonished at how shiny their nail was, and they would buy the thing for whatever it was, $15. And I was tortured. I thought that I was being tortured doing this sales because I thought, you know, nobody needs this. It's not an improvement to anyone's life to get this thing. I was creating an artificial need and an artificial desire by polishing up their nail and getting them to say, ooh, I want this. And I was full of disgust with myself while I was doing that. It seemed very exploitive and very deceitful. Also, the products that we were selling, the prices were all highly inflated. I mean, I was getting paid on commission. So there was, you know, for their $12 hand lotion, we sold a whole bunch of things. So, you know, something like a dollar of that was going to me, and then it was all these people down, all the middlemen. And so the actual cost of the thing was probably like, you know, 50 cents or a dollar. And they're paying $12 for it because there's all these different people making a profit down the road. And I really felt it wasn't honest. So I felt it wasn't honest in that the exchange of the cost for the item wasn't commensurate, that you weren't paying what the thing was worth. And also that it wasn't adding any real... I mean, we had some things that would be useful to people, you know, if they have dry skin or something, but that most of what we were selling had no value and nobody needed it. And that's the case, such is the case with so much of what is being done in the name of work in the world, things that people don't need. In fact, not only do they often not need them, but many of them are harmful, like the whole tobacco industry, the whole alcohol industry, you know, the whole slaughterhouse industry, the whole sex industry, even the legal sex industry. It's all doing things that are actually harmful for people. So one aspect of Varna Dharma is that your work should be honest and should be of real value. And then another is that, and imagine a society that's like this. Imagine a society where everybody's working according to their nature. Everyone's doing where they feel the most full expression of themselves, and where they can give their best self, where they have their training and their career. By the time they're 18, 20 years old, they know what their career is. They can work in their career wonderfully in the prime of life, and they can advise others as a retired person and so forth, and then they can get ready for death feeling satisfied, where people are sharing in charity, and so there's no extreme poverty on the planet. There's no huge wealth disparity. Where people are seeing the connection to the Lord, however they understand the Lord according to different religions, but they're seeing their connection to the Lord in their work, in their life on a regular basis, where they're striving to work above the three aspects of ego as the doer, the cause, and the enjoyer of the effects. They're striving to work as a servant of the Lord, as a soul, where the work they're doing is honest and adding real value. So imagine a society like this, right? Those are six of the principles of Varna Dharma. And then the next is that everyone is, they're keeping their forms of wealth, whether it's strength and health or beauty or leadership or knowledge, they're keeping that pure and connected with the Lord, and they're keeping their general Varna pure. Like right now we have people acting as Brahman, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Sudra, but the fields are polluted. Just like literally, you know, we have these companies that pour chemicals onto the land. They're literally polluting a literal field. But all of the fields of work, all of the areas, all the varnas, the values, the dharma of that field has been tampered with, has been adulterated, so that we don't trust knowledge coming from those who are ostensibly brahmanas. We don't trust the care and protection coming from the government. We don't trust the business practices or the agricultural practices of those in the Vaishya Dharma, and we don't trust the craftsmanship. We don't trust the objects that we and the services that we get from those in the Shudra field. You know, there's cheating throughout the fields. So in Varna Dharma, you keep your field of work honest, and you keep your type of prosperity honest. And then the eighth principle of Varna Dharma is that there's competition within the fields to keep up quality. So the Kshatriyas, they battle as to who is going to have the most righteous government, and the Brahmanas have debate to understand what is actually truth, and the Vaishyas have business competition, who is going to provide the best quality at the best price, and the Shudras have competition, who's the best dancer, and who's going to grow, you know, the biggest pumpkin, and who's going to do the best embroidery. So there's competition within the field, but then there's cooperation between the fields, that the different fields help each other, but they also act as checks and balances on each other. The Shudras, as the greatest number, they can decide whether or not to support people in the other fields. The Vaishyas can control through money and through resources. The government can control through the law. And the Brahmanas can control society by the guidelines and the direction that they send. And then the last principle of Varna Dharma is that prosperity is sustainable, that we're not looking for some unlimited growth model in prosperity, that prosperity is tied to the land, which is finite, and to the actual natural resources of the earth, which are finite, and that prosperity, people have wonderful prosperity, but they have it in harmony with nature in a sustainable way, not in some artificial growth model that's divorced from the concepts of the land. So in this way, there's a spiritual basis for society as a whole with these nine principles of Varna Dharma. But for the individual as well, you know, it's very interesting that Krishna is talking in the Bhagavad Gita a lot about detached work done for the benefit of the Lord. Detachment from being the doer, again, these three things, detachment from being the doer, detachment from being the cause, detachment from wanting to enjoy the effects of one's work, wanting instead, right, to gain the three aspects of clear ego, which is clarity, freedom from distraction, and peacefulness. And at the same time, he's really emphasizing that we should be doing work according to our nature, swa dharma, our own dharma. So what do those two things have to do with each other? You know, again, if we look at today's purport, where acting according to the material divisions for their spiritual advancement. So we've talked about the spiritual advancement of the society as a whole. But what about the individuals? Well, when I'm working according to my nature, it's much easier for me to work in a way that's detached. It's much easier for me to do the other principles of Varna Dharma if I've gotten the first one right. Because if I'm working according to my nature, I enjoy the work itself. My nature is work that I would do, that I do anyway. I do it without being paid, without being asked. It's what I do because it is my natural dharma. And when that's how I'm maintaining myself, I'm naturally getting satisfaction in my nature. Like, duh. And then, of course, you know, one needs to get paid for one's work and so forth. One needs to live. But it doesn't become the real reason why I'm working. If somebody says, well, I don't really like this job, or it's not really my thing, but at least I'm getting paid, then their attachment is more to being the doer, the cause, and it being the owner of the possessions, because they're more attached to the externals. Now, if you're attached to the externals, then you get absorbed in this false ego. And if you're absorbed in the false ego, how are you going to get absorbed in the real ego? To do work that's not your real work, and yet to be detached from the externals, it's possible, but it's extremely, extremely difficult. Because as soon as it's not my real work, my only motive becomes the externals. I lose my natural intrinsic or internal motive. I hope this makes sense to everybody. If I'm doing something I love and I enjoy, then I'm doing it because I love it and I enjoy it. And getting paid or getting recognition, or those are side effects. And so being detached from those things is so much easier. offering them to Krishna, seeing them as belonging to Krishna, right, then they're his. It's so much easier. Whereas if I'm doing work that I don't like, then I'm going to tend to be attached to the external things. And offering it to Krishna is going to be that much harder. Also, when I'm doing what I love, I'm going to be more charitable. Because I'm satisfied. Right? I'm going to be more likely to celebrate sacredness because I feel that I'm in the right place. It's going to be easier for me to see my connection with God. As we already said, it's going to be easier for me to transcend the gunas and false ego. It's going to be easier for me to do honest work and valuable work. Because again, I'm getting pleasure from the thing rather than the externals. And it's going to be easier for me to cherish my work because that's my source of satisfaction. And if I'm in the right place, it's going to be easier for me to compete within my work, cooperate with others outside, and balance appropriately because I will be in the right place. So, also a very important note in today's purport is Srila Prabhupada's statement that taking care of all this is the work of the government. This is very important. It is the duty of the government. I know of one devotee who talks about how he's establishing Varnashram communities. And he said, we've designated some people as Brahmanas and some as Vaishyas and some as Shudras. We haven't designated anyone as a Kshatriya. And my immediate reaction was, well, then it's a farce. Because only the government, only the Kshatriyas, can actually institute this. The Brahmanas can give direction. And the Brahmanas can give explanation and inspiration, but they can't actually do it. And the Vaishyas can't really do it either, and the Sudras can't do it. It's only the government that can do it. It's only the government that it can establish this kind of training in the world and to make sure that it stays that way. I mean, the Brahmanas can direct and organize initial training according to Dharma. But ultimately, the Kshatriyas have to put it into practice. They're the ones who are actually going to institute it. And without the government instituting it, it's not going to happen. It's not going to, it can't happen. There's no one else who does this but the government. That's part of their dharma. And someone else thinking, I mean, this is so ironic. Someone who's in the Brahmana Varna thinking that they're going to institute this without Kshatriyas is by definition a violation of the very thing they're trying to do. A Brahmana trying to institute this is immediately doing Paradharma. He's immediately doing someone else's duty. So how is he going to institute Swadharma when he's doing Paradharma? Just like we see in today's purport, today's verse and purport. Maharaj Bharata did his duties. You can't ask everyone else to do their duties if you're not doing your duties. So we see here in the Bhagavatam and in the teachings of Srila Prabhupada and our acharyas and the Vedic literature in general, there's not simply a discussion of utterly, totally transcendent knowledge. That's there in abundance. How we are the soul, who is God, down to a description of his toenails and his eyebrows and the decorations in his hair, his abode, a whole detailed science of rasa as to how the Lord interacts with his devotees, a whole detailed science of different types of yoga, karma yoga, gyan yoga, dhyan yoga, bhakti yoga, in order to attain the Lord. But there's also a very detailed description of how to live in the world as human beings, so that we achieve that transcendence, so that that transcendence is visible in our lives, because a lot of the hours of our day are taken up with eating and sleeping and taking care of our family and protecting ourselves. And I mean, a lot of our time. You know, even if you're a renunciate, you still have to eat and sleep and wash your clothes and clean your floor. And I mean, it's a lot. And that also has to be connected for the individuals and for society. So I regularly now have a major class that I attend that I'm a student in on Wednesdays. So it really cuts out my time here. I see that we have one question. I could take one question, and then I do need to go.
Oh, too bad. I bet you this would have gotten a lot of questions because it was a brilliant class. All right, so I'll forego the second question. I'll just ask about this last part that you were talking about. It sounded really important that if you're acting according to your nature, it's going to be a lot easier to make spiritual advancement. I didn't quite get it all. I'll have to re-listen to it. But I just wanted to say, is it like if yourself are hungry, it's going to be a lot more difficult to worry about feeding other people, but if you're satisfied, you've got enough, then you can start worrying about others. So is it kind of like the same thing?
Well, that's certainly related. But think about it's the principle is a very, very, very simple one. So let's say I'm doing something that I like. For example, I like to teach. I really like to teach. I was just recently traveling again. I went to Florida, and I was teaching a lot of classes there. And at one point, after one of my classes, people were asking me questions. So I was having the class was over. I mean, most people had left, but there were a few people around asking me questions. And I realized that I could go on, psychologically, I could go on for hours doing that. I could do it all day. I could research and teach and answer questions, and I could do it all day. I would regretfully go to eat and regretfully, oh, I have to eat. Oh, I have to go to sleep. Oh, I have to do my laundry. What a shame. You know, the psychologists and sociologists call this a state of flow, where you're very much in the moment. You're really in the moment, and it's a kind, even for a materialistic people, it's kind of a state of samadhi, where you forget your bodily needs, you forget everything, you're absorbed in what you're doing. And so, I have to eat, and I have to have a place to sleep, and, you know, I have to be able to buy shoes, and it's not like I don't have those needs, but those were not motivating me. Now, obviously, if I wouldn't get those needs met through my work, I'd have to try to get them met in another way, through my natural work. But the way that Krishna wants society designed is that we get those needs met through our natural work. So it's very easy for me, if I'm doing my natural work and I'm enjoying inside the work itself, that I can have a lot of detachment from the externals of the work, because they're not what's motivating me. I wasn't motivated because they were giving me food and a place to sleep. That wasn't what was motivating me. What was motivating me was the love of what I was doing. And I love what I was doing because it's my dharma. For someone where it isn't their dharma, they wouldn't love it at all. In fact, they would hate it. And if I do work that's not my dharma, then I don't enjoy the work. I do it as little as possible, as, you know, as rarely as possible. I spend as little time on it as possible. While I'm doing it, I can't wait to get out of it. And I'm doing it for the external rewards. I'm doing it because I'm getting paid, or I'm doing it so people can praise me, or something like that. And being detached, when you're doing work where you are attached, is almost impossible. How do I become detached from the fruits of my work if that's why I'm doing it? When I'm doing my natural work, I'm not doing it for the fruits. I'm doing it for the joy of the thing. That it's joyful in the moment. And the results are, they're a side thing. Does that make sense?
That helps. Thank you very much. And it was really, really a good class.
Yes, being in the zone, being in the flow. So we are designed to live in the flow, in the zone. all the time. That is our natural state. We are meant to live like that. We are meant to be have a very present moment awareness where we have detachment from the mundane side of life, and we're totally absorbed in being the best expression of who we are for the pleasure of the Lord. That's what we're meant to be, and anything other than that is very uncomfortable for us. And when we're in that place, acting without the components of false ego, the three components of false ego, and acting as a servant of Krishna is a very, very easy next step. It's just so easy. Because we're already feeling that way to a large extent. And if you're not in the zone, if you're not in the flow, saying, you know, let's connect this with the Lord and give up the false ego is really hard. It's possible, but it's much, much harder, and it's not the way Krishna has designed anything. All right, I do need to go. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.